So this week in Retronauts, it's summer, even here in wintry Seattle. And this is where Bob would hum the theme.
I said the new theme is way too fast for me to hum, so...
Okay, fair
enough. The old theme feels more like a dirge in retrospect.
How fitting. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out here to our first ever standalone Retronauts panel at Seattle Retro Game Expo. And I'm the host of this panel, Jeremy Parrish, and... the other hosts are with me here in front of you.
Hi, I'm Bob Mackey, and I'm a little too loud, it sounds like. How's it going? Also, some of you paid for us to be here, so the pressure's on.
Yeah. And I'm Ray Barnholt, and this is my first live Retronauts, and also I'm from Washington, so it's great to be here in Seattle. So it's a nice occasion, so yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
No place rocks like... Seattle.
It's kind of turned into exactly. One of those.
Yes.
So, this is our first ever Kickstarter-funded public appearance. And those of you who supported us and made it possible for us to be here, thank you very much. And we hope that this lives up to your expectations. Hopefully your expectations aren't incredibly high, so it's easier to do that. So for this panel, instead of doing something really hard-hitting and super insightful, we thought we'd just kind of take it easy. It is the summer months, so we decided to dwell on summer nostalgia and talk about memories of summer video gaming, not only for ourselves, but we'd also like to open up the floor to you guys later and let you share your memories and chime in if you're interested in doing that.
This was not my idea, by the way. This is not tied into my magazine, Scroll Issue 10 Summer Now.
Well, now you put the idea in all of their heads, right?
Scroll VG.com? No.
Not .com, sorry.
.vg.
.vg.
Thank you.
Anyway, guys, should we start with doing the usual lamentations about Virtual Console? Because it just wouldn't be Retronauts without those.
I think we should.
Okay. So, Virtual Console this past week. How about it, huh? It was one of those weeks where Nintendo managed to put out a lot of really great games that they wouldn't have been able to do if they gave you things like cross-purchase on multiple platforms. But since they keep everything nice and separate, they managed to sell us another copy of Super Mario Brothers 2, even though they just offered one a couple of months ago. Good job, guys.
Yeah. Hey, it's a classic.
Nice of them.
So what were the titles this week?
There was Donkey Kong for the NES and also Metroid for the NES. So if by some chance you've never played these games in the multiple chances you've had, then you're in luck.
Yeah, and actually the Donkey Kong is worth mentioning because it's actually coming out tomorrow as part of the 30 games for 30 cents for the 30th anniversary of Famicom thing. And technically right now it is... July 15th in Japan, which means that it is technically the 30th anniversary of the Nintendo Famicom. That's kind of cool. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about... Way to go, sir. Oops. Wow.
That had to happen.
Party foul. Yeah, so I'm sure we'll be talking about some NES games over the course of this hour. If you haven't heard it already, our first episode of the new Retronauts Volume 3 actually talked about the Famicom's 30th anniversary as well as the 30th anniversary of its simultaneous competitor, Sega's SG-1000, which eventually mutated into the Master System. So you've probably played some variant of the games that came out for that.
Now, I know in 1983 no one really knew what they were doing, but when do consoles normally launch in Japan? It seems like it's not in the window that we always have, you know, Thanksgiving shopping season.
Yeah.
Well, it has been most recently.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's all been like global launches, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the difference in the way the launches happened for those systems versus the way they happen now shows a lot about how the industry is kind of solidified and matured. I have no idea why both Nintendo and Sega independently decided July 15th would be the day to launch their new systems. I don't know if it's a summer vacation thing or what, but the Famicom eventually became the US, but it didn't launch in America for like 2.5 years after that. I can't even imagine a console having a 2.5-year gulf between launching in one region and another. Although maybe Xbox One will kind of do the progressive rollout thing and eventually make it to Japan a few years later. It's been kind of a little weird on that front.
Did they have to wait for Rob to be ready, you know?
Japan's buyers are kind of like America's buyers were in 1983, right, and that they don't really want anything to do with the Xbox, I think.
See, if Rob had launched in the 90s, it could have taken advantage of the Pog craze, and Rob could be stacking Pogs for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that's what a buddy does, right? He organizes your Pogs.
Yeah, you could do that already. Yeah. And, of course, the Xbox One already has its own Rob. It stares at you forever.
One unblinking robot eye connected right to the government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I guess that's probably all the banter we're going to do about that topic.
Yeah, unfortunately not even an exciting virtual console week to complain about, really. Because the games are just oh man.
They're good.
How else are we going to complain about these?
But why doesn't Nintendo give us the Pie Factory as DLC for Donkey Kong?
Yeah. Well.
Who has played the Pie Factory?
You have to go through special channels.
It is a cement factory, you know.
Oh, it's a cement factory?
Those are piles of cement.
Those are awful pies.
Yeah, I'm assuming that the game that's coming out tomorrow is not the special edition that they released for 3DS last year. It's probably just the same old NES ROM that we played and is lacking that kind of crappy, lackluster level that they dropped for no particular reason.
Right. Yeah.
No doubt.
More fun than math, though, with Donkey Kong. I find that funny that they got an ape to teach you math and they got Popeye to teach you English.
Oh, yeah, that's right. All right. Yeah.
That's going to work
spell
out.
How do you spell it?
I would need the katakana in front of me.
So anyway, summer. Like I said, it's summer out there, and summer is kind of a lazy time, so we're just going to kind of stroll down memory lane talking about old video game memories, and we hope you guys will jump in a little later and talk about your own personal memories. So that I'm not putting everyone to sleep with my sleepy voice, why don't we start from Bob's end of the table? And
I guess
share
I
with
need
Bob,
to...
what is your most beloved summer video gaming memory?
Well, I'll bring up a certain phrase, and you guys in the audience can let me know if this sounds familiar. The summer of adventure. Anybody? Nothing? Nobody? Okay. Well, this was a promotional campaign by Square back when they actually made games. And this happened in the year 2000, and what happened in that year was they were very prolific because they still had money. So every month from basically April to September, there was a new game. But three big RPGs came out in the year 2000, Legend of Mana, Threads of Fate, and Chrono Cross. And I want to count Vagrant Story because that came out in May. It wasn't part of their campaign, but it should have been, so I'm grandfathering it in.
Didn't Saga Frontier and Front Mission 3 also come out that year?
I looked it up today, and those were winter, so that was more like the winter adventure. So, but yeah, the summer adventure, the phrase is kind of misleading because releasing three RPGs in the summer, it's more like the summer for shut-ins because you're not leaving your room.
Right.
Because RPGs were really big back then, but... If you pre-ordered all of these, you got a sample soundtrack, which was not great, but it was like, here's five songs. And back then, in the days of Napster and whatnot, that was sort of interesting, you know. And also, I just found this out today, that if you pre-ordered them all at GameStop or Babbage's or Software, et cetera, whatever the multi-tentacled family of game stores that existed back then, you got a free knapsack that probably would have disintegrated within minutes, but it was still there.
So. It's for your adventure.
Yes. So you can stay hydrated so you don't pass out and die like someone in a cafe, right?
They also, in addition to the CDs and the knapsack, didn't they also release some physical goods? There was a Chrono Cross clock,
yes,
right?
Yes, the Chrono Clock.
Yeah, it was really cheaply made and fell apart actually faster than the knapsack.
Yeah, so... Yeah, it seems like free would be the optimal price for that item.
Definitely.
So yeah, basically why this is important to me, and this will make some of you feel either really young or really old, the year 2000 was when I graduated high school, and like a lot of nerds who were into video games, I didn't really like high school that much, so this was freedom for me. It's like, okay, I don't have to go to school, I have a crappy grocery store job part-time, so I can just stay in my room. With the freedom of an adult, I can just stay in my room all summer and not do anything and play cool RPGs. And in retrospect, some of these games were not that good, like Legend of Mana.
Hey.
Oh, dear.
Are you dissing Kawazu again?
Yes. But Legend of Mana, I think we can agree in retrospect that that was maybe the first sign that things were not too... The Mana ship was on its way to the bottom of the ocean, right?
I'm going to go to bat for Legend of Mana.
Please
I think it's one of those games that needs a little compassion and understanding to really properly appreciate. It was definitely different than the previous Mana games, Secret of Mana, Seiken Densetsu 3, Final Fantasy Adventure. In some senses, it was more limited, but in a lot of other senses, it was much more open and much less directed. It kind of had story paths that you could follow, but you had to find them on your own. And it basically just gave you this world to create and explore, and as you explored, you could create more of the world. And so there was kind of this back and forth between, planning your world and then going out adventuring in it. It was really interesting. A lot of the systems, because it was directed by the Saga series creator Akitoshi Kawazu, some of the systems were a little bit half baked.
Like, I would say they're more opaque than Dark Souls.
Well, a lot of them weren't necessary. Like, there was the whole golem crafting system. You could create golems, but you didn't really need to. It was just a thing you could do.
Right.
So, yeah, there was a lot of discovery, and there wasn't a lot of point to the discovery. But it was a really interesting sandbox kind of game, in a different sense of the word sandbox than we think of now, like GTA.
I will move on from that. I have no comments. Although I did try to play through it recently, and I couldn't play through it again. So we have Vagrant Story, which... not part of the campaign, but it should have been. And is that on PSN?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, yes. I don't know how well that has aged, because it seems like it was a game that was kind of pushing against the limits of the technology it was working with. I don't know. Would you guys agree with me? I mean, you needed like an entire memory card to save. The menus were lots of loading times. I don't know. It felt like a very cumbersome game, but there was a really good game underneath all the layers of, I don't know, menus and loading and everything like that. So yeah. Do you guys have good memories of Vagrant Story? I mean, I know Jeremy,
yeah,
you like it a lot.
Yeah, how about you? I've bored people with it.
I've barely played it. So,
oh.
I mean, but I think it's more elegant than you give it credit for.
Yeah, I have to go back.
It does have some technical problems that have to do with the PlayStation hardware, like the loading times for the menus. You're specifically talking, I think, about the crafting menu.
Yeah.
That's because it had so much storage capacity that it had to load from the memory card every time. And the I.O. on the PlayStation memory card was really slow. So that bogged the game down, and it made crafting kind of a hassle. But the game itself, like Ray says, is very elegant. The cinematic presentation, the way it kind of had a movie-like presentation in terms of camera angles and acting, staging, but was presented with comic book text instead of voice acting, creates this really kind of weird, almost dissonant style with like this medieval world, and then there's a comic book layered on top of it. But it's really distinctive and unique. And, you know, of course, the story, it's one of those Yasumi Matsuno games like Final Fantasy Tactics and Final Fantasy XII. So it's pretty elaborate and multi-layered, but I thought it was an interesting story, and it really compelled me. The one really big problem to the game is that it was supposed to be like 10 hours long or so, and when it was playtested, people in the company said, no, it needs to be longer than that. So they took big chunks of the game and duplicated them and just padded out the experience to like 20 or 30 hours, despite the fact that the game was really meant to be much leaner than that. So it does suffer from that kind of PlayStation era, every game has to be incredibly lengthy
and
problem.
I think, didn't Vagrant Story come in a two-disc case, even though it was a one-disc game? It was sort of like a,
I think it
was
had
there a demo in there?
With
okay,
it.
That could have been how they introduced the Summer of Adventure, actually. But I don't want to go on forever about all of these games, so I'll just briefly go over a few more and then make a few points. There was also Threads of Fate, which I think is mostly forgotten. That's also on PSN for $6. And I played through a little bit of it recently. It's an action RPG. It's a little simple for... I don't know, even for the time it feels a little simple, but there's a lot of cool systems in the game. Like, you can learn, you have two different characters, they each have their own stories, but you're not going to really understand the full story until you play through both of them. It's sort of like the zapping system in Resident Evil 2, so I can appreciate that. And one of the characters, the female character, is she uses magic. The other character is sort of like Kirby, and he can transform into monsters. And like I said, I played a little bit of it recently, and I really like the music. The music is fantastic. I can't really say that as the same about the game itself, but it's an interesting, some interesting ideas, and you know, they didn't all work out, but I think it's one of Square's better products from this time. And then we have August Chrono Cross, and this is the game that made Jeremy a celebrity on the internet, I guess.
An internet celebrity, which isn't the same thing as a real celebrity.
How did this game propel you to national stardom, Jeremy?
I wrote a FAQ for the game. That's how. Also, I helped the Gaming Intelligence Agency, which some of you may remember and may be seeing again soon. I helped them like do a bunch of early coverage when the demo came out for the game in Japan. So it was kind of the first extensive media that had been released for the game on the internet, and I happened to get a really early copy of it and went home from work and over my lunch break like videotaped a playthrough of it and then started writing about it. So it was up and people were checking that out, and I linked back to my personal site in a very selfish kind of way, and a bunch of people checked that out. So that was that. But
I think in 1999, you put up MP3s that you ripped from the demo on your website.
I did.
And that's how I burned my first CDR from Chrono Cross demo music.
Wow.
Okay. Enough about that.
And now look.
And
where
of course
we are.
That prompted the existence of the Lucky Dan fan club.
Oh right, yeah.
Yep.
Is that still operating?
I don't know.
Dan
I didn't hear
club?
Any cheers, so clearly people have forgotten Lucky Dan, and that's really a damn shame. Because
yeah.
Lucky Dan, he's magical, guys.
Disbanded. Misappropriation of funds.
So as I wrap my little section up, the point I wanted to make in looking back at this, and it's like we sometimes are clouded by nostalgia and to think that things were better. In this case, I think things were a little better because just thinking about, okay, this is a Japanese publisher. Every month they're putting out a console game. Look at what's happening to publishers now. Square, if you want to look at what they're doing, they're having problems putting out remakes. But 13 years ago, every month a new console game. It just, I find it very troubling and sad. I don't know, how do you guys feel about this? Final Fantasy 27, that's going to be in a new calendar year that is undetermined yet by NASA. So we're all looking forward to those previews. How about you guys? What do you feel about the state of, I guess, development? Like, what does it say about development now? I mean, it's obvious, but I don't know if you guys have any comments about this or not.
Well, I mean, I think you have smaller developers to look to for this kind of game, for this kind of experience, the indie developers, for the most part.
Right.
The big publishers they're pursuing big profit margins, so they don't create as many smaller games like these. But, you know, that was kind of par for the course in the PlayStation era. It's just a change in the industry, very
right.
similar to changes in the motion picture industry.
And also, conceivably, Square does have games they could bring us every month. Like, we haven't heard anything about Dragon Quest VII, Dragon Quest X, and I guess Bravely Default, they were held hostage and forced to release it or something like that. But that's just how things are different.
I think Nintendo took pity on them and said, okay, guys,
yeah.
We'll put it out for you.
So, yes, in conclusion, the past was better, and now I'm an old sad man.
Yeah.
Who wants to go next?
I have a few different things of varying length, I guess. I guess the first, you know, it's kind of summer game that really popped into mind was Earthbound, because that came out around the time of my birthday at the time, so I just got it for my birthday, and then it just became the game that I played all that summer. And so, I mean, I know people, everybody has their personal Earthbound stories, and I guess, you know, I don't think I can add a whole lot to it, but, you know, if you know Earthbound, you know you love it, and I'm definitely in that club. And that was just, you know, the first real important summer game for me, I think.
Actually, my first Earthbound experience was that summer, too. And I played it and got about halfway through and said, yeah, it's boring. I've come around, but But at the time, I didn't share your sense of wonderment.
Security will show you out.
I think that game is evocative of summer, though, because it's about kids with no restrictions, just running wild.
True.
And I don't know.
Yeah, I was 12, and that was still appealing, mm-hmm. for sure. And I didn't have an ATM card at the time. I mean, Ness does, but yeah.
My dad gave me money for beating up dogs, but that's different.
Another thing is that I was also there for the Saturn launch, and I managed to get one. I didn't know that it was surprise launch at E3, but like I think that same week I just randomly went to Toys R Us and saw it there in the case. Like, what the hell? So I think a little bit later I managed to get one and got. Of course, Virtua Fighter, which was packed in, and Daytona USA, which I loved. The Saturn port's not that great in retrospect, but it was definitely really worth it, I think, at the time.
And then, your rendition of the Daytona theme is still one of the highlights of YouTube.
I don't know, you should look it up. Yeah. I think it was only on game videos.
Oh.
Yeah. What else? And Clockwork Knight, like... I kind of didn't know what to expect from Clockwork Knight at the time, but it was kind of a surprisingly good platform game. It kind of reminds me of Puppeteer now, that the PS3 game that Sony's coming out with. It's very similar in style and so the same sort of spirit to it.
So no love for Bug then?
No, I skipped out on Bug, thank God. yeah, so those are like those... big three games that I kind of got during the Saturn's launch and just sort of played those for the rest of the summer on top of Earthbound once that came into view. So the next big thing, if you're from around here, has anyone ever gone to the toy test at the Science Center? Yeah. So that was held in the summers. I may be still. But anyway, it was a big thing put on by like CBS or something, their consumer division. And they would set it up at the Science Center. It was kind of like a really tiny E3 in a way. You would just go in and play the new games that were coming out later in the year. And so I went in 94, I think. And that was a pretty big year because you had like Donkey Kong Country was shown there. Like Dynamite Heady. I remember that's where I fell in love with Dynamite Heady and immediately knew that I would be buying that soon. And then, but anyway, basically the toy test was all these kids playing on these demo stations. Then you would fill out the comment cards and then drop them in. And then I guess that would give the consumer, the journalists, whatever, the lead on what's going to be hot this holiday. And
just by seeing which games the children gravitated
right,
toward.
Yeah. Nintendo also had a Wario Blast there. It was like a really buggy version of Wario Blast, the Game Boy Bomberman game that has Wario in it for no reason at all. so yeah, I remember going to the toy test. I had my mom and my best friend. We took a road trip down there that summer in August, like I said. And yeah, that was a fun day of just playing all these new games. And I was like, 11 or 12. And it's just like, yeah, it's almost like E3, except not. And just really magical for me, just having that sort of experience and getting to sample something. I wouldn't be out for a few months.
Can you remember any of the comments you left, like turn Diddy's hat backwards immediately?
No, I don't think it was. I don't remember if you wrote anything necessarily. It was just like filling out numbers, scale of 1 to 10 type stuff. But yeah, I remember a lot of the games there. Like I said, Donkey Kong, Dynamite Heady, Wario Blast. Also, they had a Jaguar display. You could play Bubsy for Jaguar if you really wanted to.
Did you get to play Cybermorph?
No, I think it was already out by then, maybe.
So yeah. You had already petted the kitty.
Yeah. No, that's the one thing I never got on the ground floor on, was the Jaguar, sorry.
I think they bus kids in from prison to play the Bubsy game. It was like a scared straight program.
Possibly, yeah. So yeah, like that was what popped in my mind the most, The toy test for sure was a big thing, and yeah. If you were there, I'm sure you know what it was like, the excitement. Sampling everything there. Your turn.
All right. Yeah, actually, you talking about the Saturn launch, I don't know why, but for some reason that made me remember, I guess, 1997. I had just picked up a Sony PlayStation, and I was at a Walmart or something, and I saw a video loop of upcoming games, and one of them was this insane-looking Castlevania game. And having been a Castlevania fan from, you know, child times, I was really, really fascinated by this. But it turned out that the game may or may not have been localized for the U.S. There was some debate about whether it was actually coming or not.
Oh, that's right.
So as it turned out, there was a kind of a sketchy video game shop in my town, and they happened to sell some import games. And most of their games, their import games were PC games, and they were against a wall and kind of hidden out of sight because most Japanese PC games are the kind of things you have to hide out of sight. But they did have some console games, and it turned out that they would also do modding for your systems if you wanted them to, you know, for a nominal fee. So when I found out that they were going to be getting a copy of Castlevania Symphony of the Night from Japan, I dropped down, like, I think it was probably like $125 to have my system modded and get a copy of the import game. And I went into that not knowing any Japanese whatsoever and discovered that it was a very intricate game and had a lot of menus and a lot of words. And so I had a very quick crash course in learning to read some rudimentary Japanese that summer. But, I mean, it was absolutely worth it because the game was just completely brilliant. You know, so many PlayStation games and games on Saturn and 64 at that time also really pushed toward 3D graphics and the kind of classic hand-drawn sprite art of games, you know, 2D games that I had been playing for the past decade, 15 years, however long, was really being pushed by the wayside. And playing that game and seeing what could be done with, you know, much more advanced technology offered by the PlayStation with that kind of classic style, that, you know, it didn't have to be a dead end of technology, that you could use more powerful systems to make more visually stunning and more intricate and more expansive classic style games. I don't know, I think that was kind of the moment at which this podcast was perhaps birthed in its most nascent form. But it, I mean, it was just really a stunning game, and I played that obsessively and probably spent like a month just picking it over. And before people started to kind of dissect it on the internet, there were, you know, some fan pages that cropped up in the coming months. But before I knew about all the kinds of ins and outs and some of the elemental effects and things that you could equip and some of the secrets, I actually beat the game the hard way. You know, there's a super boss in the second castle who's like two stories tall and zaps you with electricity, and you can get an item that completely nullifies his electric attacks. But I didn't know that at the time, so I actually fought him with this really tedious battle where anytime he would do the lightning attack, I would turn Alucard into fog and just wait it out and then turn back and attack him like once or twice and then turn back into fog. It probably took like 20 minutes, and it was just completely stupid, but I did it, and I felt really proud of myself. And then like a few weeks later, I learned about the barrel bracelet and said, oh, that was a waste of time.
Did you figure out much more of the story after that? I mean, did you learn anything more about that, or did you kind of like have to wait till it came out in English?
I discovered that a man is a miserable pile of secrets.
Right, right.
I mean,
right.
That's kind of the essential. No, there were.
Did you get the full impact of that in Japanese? Though?
I'm more of a stack of secrets, neatly arranged. Yeah. You know,
I didn't get the full impact of the exquisite English text, of course, in Japanese. But I did get the impact of the actual conversation they were having, because they actually voice acted it in Japanese as opposed to doing the "Die, monster! You don't belong in this world."
I think the acoustics of this room match the acoustics of the room they recorded that in.
I think they recorded the English version's voice acting in a bathroom, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
They just had a little cassette tape recorder and pointed it at a dude and they're like, "Talk." No, but I did not actually figure out the secret ending on my own. But, you know, because those fan pages popped up pretty quickly, I was able to, you know, finish the game properly. But I don't know, that sense of discovery and mystery is something that has always been a big part of video gaming's appeal for me. Like, not necessarily knowing what you're going in for and then kind of having this experience that you don't expect and may not be able to figure out entirely on your own. You know, you want to share with friends and trade secrets and tips and that sort of thing. And that was interesting because, you know, I was kind of living on my own and didn't know any people who liked video gaming at that time. So I was kind of experiencing that game by myself. But at the same time, there was that communal social element that made me say, oh, the internet's really good for this kind of thing. Maybe I should pay attention to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a pretty interesting experience for me. I don't know if you guys were interested by what I just talked about, but at least I enjoyed it.
I thought of something else.
Yeah?
Is that after I graduated sixth grade, it was a real roller coaster of a day, emotional roller coaster of a day. And so I went home and just spent like the rest of the afternoon playing 32X Doom, because that was the only version of Doom I could properly play. Didn't have a good enough computer at the time, so that sticks out in my brain. That's a nice summer, pre-summer memory. Does it crash all the time? I don't even remember. I know it doesn't have enough levels, so...
I also wanted to mention garage sales were a big thing for me in the summer when I was a kid, just finding new games, because, I mean, where we are here is like sort of like a giant garage sale, people, you know, selling you things. But the difference between the people selling you games here and garage sales, the people in charge of garage sales are parents who have no respect for their children's possessions, and they want them away from the house. So because I had frugal parents and frugal grandparents, they would take me to garage sales, and if a game was $5, I would get it because, oh, these games are typically $50. So that's how I got Clash of Demon Head and a bunch of other really cool rare games, because at the time, and you guys probably realize this, like, you could hear about a game in Nintendo Power, but it would not actually be in any stores around you because some stores would just not get some games. So I would end up finding rare games there. Yeah. And my greatest garage sale find was a copy of Double Dragon where someone or something had peed on the instruction manual. I never figured out that mystery, but their last name was Hamzik, so I'm going to look it up starting today.
Yeah, one of the things I remember about just, you know, video gaming in the summer is that with all that free time also came a lot of summer-specific chores. You know, your parents were like, well, you're sitting around in the house, so why don't you go mow the lawn or, you know, paint the garage or something. And those times actually became, those times, you know, doing chores became actually kind of valuable for my gaming time, because I would be playing, you know, these NES games that were much more complicated and bewildering than anything I expected from, you know, the arcade games I'd been used to before that. So I would get to a point in something like The Legend of Zelda or Metroid where I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do next. And so I would go out and just like mull these things over in my head as I was doing chores for a few hours, and then I'd come back and would have settled on a solution. So
I came up with, I just thought of a very great image of you setting bushes on fire in your front yard and then going back to Zelda.
It's like, I
yes,
wonder.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
When you live in West Texas and it's very, very dry, it's a really good idea to set everything on fire.
Well, you don't know what treasures you're going to find, so.
Yeah. Staircases.
Such as a new house to live in.
Oh, yeah.
Insurance claims, great. Yeah, Ray, something you said about Earthbound being this quintessential summer game actually kind of made me think about, you know, the whole appeal of summer games, gaming in the summer, because, you know, when you're a kid, you do have all this free time and you have to fill it, and you go out and play with friends or do chores or whatever, but there is this kind of sense of, I don't know, when you're a kid, summer is 3 months, so like it seems like it just stretches on forever and you can do so much.
Yeah,
and I think that is a lot of appeal of these memories that we have, because you're able to pack in so much gaming time compared to, you know, we're all boring adults. We don't have that opportunity. We have to kind of take our gaming sessions when we can, or stay up really late and sacrifice being competent at work the next day.
Right. And of course, you know, it helps being an RPG nerd at the time too. Yeah, because you can, you know, you're always going to have these new releases to play, these brand new adventures. You can have your own summer of adventure, depending on what, you know, platform you have and what you're into.
Yeah, the rise of the rental market, I think, made summer vacation a lot more tolerable once that started to take off. There was a Hastings, which was, I think, local in Texas, game and music and bookstore, and they started doing game rentals. And there was one summer, probably 1989, 1990, and they started offering these coupons where you could rent something and then be able to, I think, get like free days of rentals. And I hoarded all these coupons that I could find. And so for the entire summer, I would bike, you know, the 10 blocks over to the local Hastings, and I would just pick over my favorite, or the most enticing, I guess, NES games, you know, games that I would never necessarily buy because I didn't know if they were going to be any good, but because they were $1.50 for like a week's rental, it was basically just kind of this this buffet of great gaming options. And I actually, became kind of a dick about it, and they didn't have the games themselves out on the shelves. They had these little tags, and you would take those up to the front counter, and you would give the tag to the clerk, and they would go and they'd dig the game out for you.
Like Toys R Us?
Yeah, sort of like that. So anytime there was a game that I thought was really intriguing, but I wanted to play something else first, I would take that tag and hide it in like the adult video section or something, where no one could possibly, like no one who would be interested would possibly find it. It would just be tucked behind stuff. And then I would come back, you know, a few days later and know that no one would have rented it and I could check it out.
I see.
And I'm not necessarily proud of this, but, you know, you gotta get the most out of your money when it's so hard to come by.
You do what you can.
That store was also interesting because it's the only place I've ever actually seen those Panesian NES pornographic games in the public. They actually had those for rental in the adult video gaming section, so maybe the adult section wasn't the best place to hide stuff.
Well, those old porn boxes were so big you could hide anything behind them, you know?
I wouldn't know.
I'm going to have to take your word on that one.
I was a curious child. I did want to say, like, I had a similar thing where a video store by me, as they started getting SNES and Genesis games, they stopped caring about NES games, so they were all a dollar. But all the NES games were that one wall of the video store that the sun always hit, so you could not read the labels anymore. So you had to like sort of like turn the box around and like to decipher what exactly you were renting. So that was always a fun experience for me. I remember that.
Actually, I do remember another summer thing, since we're talking about video stores and all that. I remember going to like the local IGA grocery store and getting like Dragon Warrior 3 in like 1993 for like $10. Because, you know, when you go to the grocery store video section, all their old video games would be like $9.99, like blanket price for everything. So it worked for some games like Dragon Warrior 3 and some and others not so much. But yeah, that was also like that summer rest of the year basically was when I started getting back into like NES and, you know, rediscovering all that stuff.
Summers in the NES era were sometimes kind of this sort of waiting game, because you would see games advertised in magazines and, you know, there'd be these big exclusive blowout previews. But you didn't actually know when the games were coming out, because there was no rigid video game industry at that point. There were no set release dates. It was like, this is coming out in that month, maybe.
I don't think we had, in the
case of something like Zelda 2, it would be coming out in this month, but actually, no, like 8 months later.
Wouldn't Nintendo Power just say like summer or winter?
Or August.
I don't even think we had quarters. It was like first half of year.
Right.
It was kind of a guessing game. So you would see something in the magazines, and you basically obsess over it for a few weeks, a few months, until finally it showed up at the stores. And Mega Man 2 is one of those games for me. I remember, you know, seeing the Nintendo Power spread that had those two really big, super impressive bosses that show up at the end of the game in Dr. Wily's castle. And right there, I was sold on the game, and I had to have it. But that game, you know, didn't come out for several months later. And so, you know, to while my time away, I decided to hunt down the first Mega Man and actually found a copy, like the last standing copy in the city, and played that. And, you know, that kind of gave me the introduction to the series, so I was ready for the second one when it came out. But I have a very specific memory of that game, because after taking it home, you know, after kind of dwelling on it for a few weeks, like, do I really want to spend $35 on this game and maybe not be able to buy something I want more later? I went ahead and pulled the trigger and bought it, and I took it home. And I remember playing, and as I finished the first level, my mother came in and handed me this letter, and it was a letter from the girl I had a crush on. And so we developed a really good friendship over the summer as pen pals, but... Yeah, so maybe that's why I like the Mega Man series so much. There's this little happy memory attached to my very first experience with Mega Man.
Aww.
Isn't that sweet? Yeah. Anyway, maybe you've heard enough of our nostalgic pining. Why don't you guys come up and jump on the microphone? We'd love to hear some other stories, maybe something that's not, you know, NES games and PlayStation games and Saturn games. So please, feel free to hop on the mic, introduce yourself, where you're from, and tell us an awesome story.
Yeah. Okay, my name is Ian. I'm from here in Seattle. Two of the games I think I played a lot during the summer was, I played a lot of Super Mario RPG. It was a really interesting game. Yeah,
that was a summer game for me too. I remember mowing lawns and having like a Mario RPG fund because that game was like $70 when it came out.
Right, yeah.
So I had my own Kickstarter for that one.
That, and I played a bunch of the versus mode in Mario Bros. 3 in Super Mario All-Stars.
Mm. Oh, really? Wow.
Yes.
That's like one of those modes that, you know, people sort of sample but don't really play for very long.
Weird.
So that's interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
I am Jim. I'm from Rhode Island. My main summer memory is me and my friend Chad in the summer playing Ninja Turtles 3 while listening to Bryan Adams waking up the neighbors over and over again.
This rocks.
Yeah, it was
Canada's so amazing, guys.
So, hey, honey, I'm packing you in. And that's basically what we did.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Was that of the Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves era, Bryan Adams?
It was more rocking than that.
Okay.
It was like...
Rod Stewart hadn't gotten to him yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the thing, you know, we weren't talking too much about multiplayer stuff. And, you know,
we were all lonely.
Did we have friends?
Children?
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but...
But no, I mean, I know there were times when we did play, like, Ninja Turtles and other sorts of those multiplayer kind of games. And so, yeah. If anybody else has more of that, please. But anyway...
My name is Patrick, and I remember, I guess it was the summer of 1999, my family would always go...
That was a Bryan Adams song, wasn't it?
maybe.
Yeah.
But we would always go up to our beach cabin for like a week each summer, and one summer I was able to convince my mom to drive about 40 minutes taking a ferry almost into Houston. We had a cabin near Galveston, Texas, and she rented me a Japanese Dreamcast and Sonic Adventure.
Yeah.
And so that was a few months before it came out here. And I remember playing that in front of like the window unit of our beach cabin with the AC blowing in my face. And
wow.
It was, you know, Sonic in 3D.
That was a summer of Sonic Adventure.
Yes. Yeah. And I also had my summer of adventure in the same spot.
So nice. was that when Blockbuster was doing the early rentals, or did you rent it someplace else?
It was at Hollywood Video.
A Hollywood Video.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't they turn out to be the same thing? They're both dead, right?
Okay.
They're both
in
dead.
In the end, we all look the same underground.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, Nate. I live here in Seattle, but I grew up in Eastern Washington in a tiny town about an hour from civilization. And so I have two summer memories that stick out. One is I went to this camp and I was able to stay with my grandparents who lived in Spokane for about, you know, a week. And their neighbor had Final Fantasy II, Final Fantasy IV, but two for the SNES. So I would go over to his house every day after summer camp, after the session at summer camp. And I'll never forget the opening scene, right? And I was just like, wow, my mind was blown. Because previously, I just read Nintendo Powers that we had and was like obsessing over A Legend of Zelda Link to the Past. Never had a Super Nintendo myself. We had a Nintendo and all my friends had Super Nintendos. But that was one big summer memory. The second one was I had a job my freshman year of high school where I managed home storage. Like they dump wheat in these bins. And so I had a weigh station all to myself. And we got like a truck an hour. So I put my PlayStation in there and had Final Fantasy Tactics. And I would just keep an eye out. And there was a guy that worked with me, and he'd come in and watch the game. He didn't really understand the game, but every time I hit something, he'd be like, yeah, get him, yeah. Like, bust him up. So those are two memories that really stick out for summer in a really small town. So
yeah.
Before the days of texting, I had a friend who played Final Fantasy Tactics Advance at stoplights.
Oh, God.
He did turns at stoplights. <That's dangerous. laughs> He's still alive. Hi, Chris.
Yeah. Hi, guys. My name is Greg. I live here in Seattle. Thanks for coming out, and thanks for keeping podcasting. It's I guess I'm basically saying thank you for letting me give you money. So,
thank you
for giving us
money.
We'll
be outside if you want to give us more.
No problem.
So I have two kind of short summer memories. One is I don't think Sonic 2 came... I don't remember when Sonic 2 came out. I don't remember if it was in the summer or not, but I remember being in a very hot car reading the instruction manual cover to cover, I think just after my mom had purchased it for me. So that's my earliest, I think, summer-specific video game memory. And I actually have a recent summer memory that I really was happy about was I had never played Chrono Trigger before. I didn't have an SNES as a kid, and I was not really a big RPG fan, but I last summer I was unemployed, so I figured, hey, what the hell, I'll try it. And I was just really absorbed by it in a way that I hadn't been absorbed by a game in like a really long time. So those are my two summer memories. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the loss of video game manuals is really a detriment to this generation of young gamers because, you know, sitting in your parents' back seat and poring over the manual and reading all the lore and reading all the stupid enemy names and all these dumb little details, I don't know, that was part of the experience, the excitement of you just bought a new game and you can't play it yet, but you're kind of like filling your brain with as much of that content as you can until you can actually plug it into your system. Well, and now you get to read like the safety tips.
On the ride home, you can memorize your Nintendo Club code and put it in, you know.
Yeah. Sure. I'm going to type this in by memory.
Right.
I think that moment of anticipation is one thing that might be lost today, so that's a little sad. Thanks, guys.
No problem. I will say Sonic 2 came out on Sonic Tuesday.
I know, but do which you remember is, what Tuesday it would have
was
been?
It in November?
Rick? Wasn't it the Tuesday after Mortal Monday?
It was the fall. It was the fall.
I think Wacky Races Wednesday was the end of that naming scheme. Man, I'm sorry.
You're not forgiven.
I'm Sam. I'm from Ohio, and I've got two quick memories. One of them, during the summers, my parents would often go camping at a campground. And so being in a trailer is not a lot of room to play multiplayer games, and this was the summer N64 is really big. And so I made some friends with some guys at this campground. We're like, oh, let's play Diddy Kong Racing and GoldenEye. This is going to be great. But we had no place to play. So after we mulled over what to do a little bit, we took some extension cords, plugged them into one of the local trailers, wheeled it out into the middle of the lot, set up a bunch of folding chairs, and just played like right there in the middle of this camping lot.
Wow.
While people drove by, watched us yell and scream at each other, swear. So that was fun. And the other one, I don't know if you guys have had this experience, but I have older brothers. One of them was playing Resident Evil on the PlayStation. And me being the little older brother, he handed me one of the strategy guides. He goes, hey, walk me through these puzzles as I'm doing it. Start playing. And you get to that beginning scene where you're, you know, maybe it's Jill, you're walking around, and you see your first zombie, and they have the cinematic where he kind of turns around. Mm-hmm. Ran out of the room, and I think probably 3 weeks afterwards, every night I woke up screaming.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God.
That's what I got.
No.
If it makes you feel better, as primitive as that CGI is, it's still really spooky looking, that zombie.
It's true, man. Thank you, Shinji Mikami.
Yeah, the camping story reminds me. We used to go camping with my grandparents. They had, you know, a little RV. And this was when portable TVs were pretty uncommon. So they had this really cool little black and white TV that had about a 2-inch screen. And I was constantly trying to talk them into letting me take my NES and plug it in and play Super Mario Brothers 3 on a tiny 3-inch screen, and they just refused. They said, no, we're going out on vacation, and you need not to play video games, okay? Go get some sunshine, pale boy.
Meanwhile, we brought a TV.
So I'm also a Seattle local. I remember going to the toy test, and I remember going in 95, and it was Donkey Kong Country 2 and Yoshi's Island, which was really awesome, and then you look over and the Jaguar booth had Rayman and Gex. And it was like, yeah, I think I'm going to stick with the Super Nintendo. But my big summer memory, I don't know, when did Mystical Ninja on the N64 come out?
I think that was 97.
Yeah.
Yeah, 97.
In America.
Yeah. I remember it as a summer memory, though. I don't know if it came out in the summer, but I remember, like, I don't think I was in school, and I was really excited for it because Nintendo Power had been hyping it up, and it looked really awesome, and I loved the first one on the Super Nintendo. So I biked uphill to the local video store to rent it. Like, I wanted to, you know, day one, I want to play this game. And super excited, and I'm biking home downhill, like, all the way down, and I'm just, like, you know, all out, and I fly off my bike and go right in the street, and, you know, my arm and leg are all ripped up and bloody.
Dear Lord.
And I walk home just covered in blood, all ready to play Mystical Ninja.
The important question was the game okay?
The game was fine. Game was fine. That's all that mattered, right? I think I used my body
because you can grow new skin
it.
Back, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I don't know. Yeah.
And then I'm sitting there on the couch with my arm propped up with, you know, gauze all over it and playing the game with my left hand. Yeah, but that's a great memory.
You know,
yeah.
Whenever I'm feeling down, I just put on that opening song from that game.
Yes.
It makes me feel good about myself. So I bet that helped you.
Let's going now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want a campaign to have someone add that to karaoke machines because I could probably do that song.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if I went through that sort of ordeal to get any game, I would convince myself it was worth it.
Hey guys, I'm Paul. I live in Seattle as well. And thanks again for letting us give you money. And Ray for doing No More Whoppers and for Scroll.
Thank you. Yeah.
I really tried to milk the system of acquiring games when I was a kid, in that there were exactly two games a year that you could be guaranteed to get for me, which was Christmas and a birthday. And my birthday was right at the beginning of summer, so I have a bunch of great memories of my birthday game being the game of summer. And my first one was Kirby's Adventure. Mm-hmm. My cousin had Kirby's Dream Land, which was my first Game Boy experience, and I was so jealous of him. And mm-hmm. I picked up Kirby's Adventure, and I had no idea that this was the superior game and was going to basically be a classic later. But Mischief Makers was my first introduction to Treasure. And I also remember picking up my PS2 for a birthday when I was a kid, and not a summer memory, but a summer was the only time I ever had enough time in a day to sit around and try to dodge 200 lightning bolts to get Yuna's ultimate weapon.
Oh, boy.
So you got the special weapon, the ultimate sword, was it?
I think it was Yuna's doll, was it?
Okay.
I don't remember.
You could do that all over again next winter.
Yeah.
I'll try.
$40.
Yeah.
Thank you. Get ready.
Hi, guys. I'm Eric. I'm from around here, too. I'm glad you brought up rental stores, because I remember one summer I had some friends over to stay the night, and so we walked all the way down to the rental store to get something, you know, to play that night. And it was like 2 miles, which for kids who are in like fifth grade is like super far, you know. So we walk all the way down there. We rent Street Combat for the Super Nintendo. I don't know why we picked that game. We thought it would be, you know, a good fighting game or something.
You were Ranma 1/2 fans, right?
No.
Were they out of tough enough?
What's that?
Were they out of tough enough?
I think they did have that. We knew that one was not going to be good. But so we walk all the way back. We play like 10 minutes of Street Combat. Like, good Lord, this is... And even back then, like, because our standards were lower, but we knew, like, this is unplayable. We can't do this. We walked all the way back and told them, like, guys, can we please just rent a different game? This is so bad. That's the only time I've ever taken something back to a rental store and said, can I just exchange it for something else? And they let us get Rampart, which was actually pretty good. So
yeah, all right. So. Yeah.
Good exchange.
Yeah.
My name's Trevor. I also live here in Seattle. Earliest memory I can think of is my dad, through his company, he'd go up to Seattle, to Lake Chelan. And at the hotel we stayed at, they had, in certain hotels, they have those pay-per-view things, and they often have, like, video games where you can pay and play for, like, half hour to an hour.
They still have those. I've never seen a controller newer than the N64 controller in hotels.
They have a GameCube one.
No. Oh, they do? Yeah. Oh, my God.
The one that they had at that time was for SNES, and... You know, you paid like $30, and I played Link to the Past. And at that point, I'd only played the first game on the NES. And so playing it, you go up to the castle, and I found this path around the back. And I didn't know what happened in the game at that point. And you go around, and go in the castle, and you find Zelda. And bringing her out, I thought... Like, I had found some kind of weird, like, I had bypassed, like, 90% of the game, and I'd gotten to the end. It's like, hey, I won already, you know? and then years later, I found out that, no, this was just the first part. And so, oh. It's like, no, I need another $25 to figure it, to complete it here in the next. Yeah. So, that was kind of disappointing.
Yeah. Not the most conducive game to put on that service.
No.
Hi, guys. My name's Jason. I'm from the Bay Area. And I remember back in about 2000, I was a freshman in high school, and over spring break, I'd taken a trip to Disneyland. And I came back, and I was like, guys, I just played this crazy arcade game called Dance Dance Revolution. It's insane. And sure enough, that summer, like, those arcades started popping up, like, around where I grew up. Uh-huh. So, like, while a lot of my friends kind of spent that summer, like, trying to get better at tennis so they could join the team or something. Me and a couple of friends were like, we're going to get really good at DDR. That's what we're going to spend our summer doing. We spent like, there were like so many websites dedicated to like listing where you could find arcade machines of that. Like we'd be like, oh, Mountain Mike's has the new version. Yeah. We should go there. We all downloaded like the PC emulators, Step Step Revolution or Dance with Intensity and things.
Right.
And we just like, play it on auto mode and like just do the dance moves in front of the computer. And the sad thing is we spent so much time like putting so much effort into getting good, and we didn't really get that good, unfortunately. like my friend actually did manage to passed some of those like nine steppers. He was in much better shape than I was, so he got really good. And he even, you know, modded one of his cloth pads that he got for the PlayStation to like a big wooden panel so that he could actually get like the full, you know, the full actual like support. But yeah, I just remember every summer it'd be like, well, we got nothing to do, like, let's just go to the bowling alley and play DDR all day.
So despite your long lead time over everyone else with your DDR knowledge, you're saying you never got good enough to play it with facing away from the screen?
Oh, no. That was way beyond us. And we'd always see somebody doing that, too, at the arcade. It was really annoying. They'd, you know, put the blind mode, and it's like, do you, like, literally do this all day? Because we do it, like, half the day, and we're still not that good.
I wonder if they have regrets about their life choices. Yeah. I have to say, though, I played it a lot, too, and I'm really glad the rise of DDR did not coincide with the rise of cell phone cameras, and because I don't know if I'd be here. I'd probably be hiding somewhere.
That would have been embarrassing, yeah. But it was good times.
Yeah, nice.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gary. I'm from Portland. Hey, Bob. So my parents got divorced when I was young, so summers meant staying at my dad's, and he had a full-time job, so I would be in this kind of colony where I had no friends, but also couldn't spend time with my family. So for me, summer gaming was a lot about being kind of in an isolation tank with a game, and that would allow me to power through a lot of really inscrutable things. So that was, I have like one summer of Castlevania 2, I have a summer of Battle of Olympus. I was
wasn't
two
that
summer.
Inscrutable. That was one of those games I rented for $1.50 after hiding it.
Yeah. to my young mind, it was definitely you know, a little bit more advanced than what I had played. And that's really my summer thing, was kind of that lack of options, you know, of things to do. You know, I'd be told to go outside and play, but there was no one to play with. I don't know if I was supposed to just run around in circles or what. But instead, I would just kind of be held hostage by these games. Do you guys have any memories of, like, situations in which you have been, your options have been reduced, and it kind of made you make some compromises in what you would play?
Yeah, that's a good question. Racking my brain.
I remember starting Star Ocean 2 over in the middle of a game, and I can't imagine have that much time being available to me now. You know?
Yeah, I actually got to the Northern Crater, the very final dungeon of Final Fantasy VII, and said, I didn't play this right, so I started over from the beginning, and then I beat the game. Yeah, I can't see myself doing that. That's a total waste of time, and I was an idiot. I don't know if that's quite what you're asking for, but yeah. Certainly we've made some poor decisions in our gaming time.
We're all adults now.
On a happier topic, speaking of divorce, as a kid, you were really smart to know, like, I'm going to visit my friend when he's visiting his dad for the weekend because there are no rules.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It was like Mr. Mom up in there. So,
oh, yeah.
If any kids are listening, go to the dad's house when it's his time for visitation because, you know, it's party time.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. I'm Eric. I'm originally from Minnesota, and I wanted to hear about your scarring summer video game memories, because one of my most vivid memories was my parents didn't really like video games. It was a really big deal when they let me and my brother rent a PS1, and I had only had an NES growing up. And so trying to figure out what game to, you know, use for the 5 days that I had the PS1, I had always loved Mega Man 3, I beat a million times, played, rented them all, even rented 6. Which nobody ever played on the original NES, because, you know, none of my friends had SNESs. So I see Mega Man X4, and I'm like, yes, like, what's Mega Man been up to for 10 years? And I get to, like, the first cutscene, and Zero's like, damn. And I'm like, what did you do? You just ruined, like, my childhood memories of Mega Man. And I think forever I've kind of held a slight against the X series, even though I've replayed them and enjoyed it. And I kind of hate Sony as... I always have this internal struggle of like, oh, you ruined my favorite character. So like, did
Well, wait, first of all, I mean, swearing is cool.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
What are you talking about?
I was still like young.
No,
Ray, clearly...
it's fucking cool.
Yeah.
No, I just was like a 12-year-old scarred, and it just like didn't feel like Mega Man, which I, you know, makes me sound like a tool maybe, but.
Yeah. Were you happier about Mega Man 8's cutscenes? Because those were,
no, God,
those were much,
I
Mega Man, those are
like...
much Kid Fwinwia.
Yeah.
You're going to enjoy saving the world with Dr. White.
That's the only game where they included outtakes as part of just the main vocal track.
That game is so bad.
Oh, if only I could do a falsetto. I'd be joining in.
So I guess scarring summer memories. Video game memories. Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a TurboGrafx 16. That's scarring in and of itself.
Oh, come on.
I got an SNES later that Christmas, but I remember I really wanted Darkwing Duck, the version for the TG-16. And like Jeremy was saying earlier, you didn't know when things were coming out. They would just show up in a store one day. And for some reason, I didn't get it for my birthday because it wasn't out, and I had a choice, and I chose Impossible.
Excellent.
And you could probably guess by the name of the game how the quality of the game. So I tried to like that game. And I remember, I was so upset that I hated the game, I, wrote my mom a letter, Mom, we need to take this game back. I do not like it. I'm sorry. I had you get this one instead. And I think we actually did take it back, but I forget what I got instead. So that game caused me to start my own letter-writing campaign, I guess.
Well, I don't have a scarring memory, but I do have, a severe disappointment. And actually sort of ties into, running around town trying to find stuff. I saw on the news a story about Famicom Games in Bothell had just gotten in the import N64, because that had come out in June or July in Japan. And so I made my mom drive all the way down to Bothell and just drive around town trying to just look for the store, because we couldn't even find that. And we even had to stop at 7-Eleven to use the payphone to try and find it in the phone book. Couldn't do that either. Long story short, I did not get an import N64. All because I cannot find the stupid game store in Bothell. So there you go.
I can't think of any scarring video game memories, but I don't know. I have been thinking about a game that I associate with a really tough time. I guess it was 10 years ago, I had a really, really tough breakup with a girlfriend that I'd been with for a long time, and she was just like, later, dude. And yeah, it was really pretty crushing, and I spent a lot of time really heavily invested in Castlevania Aria of Sorrow just to take my mind off of that. And
apt.
Yeah,
it really apt was, come to think of it. But no, I mean, that was...
composing your own
Aria. It was a really
Aria
well-timed time. Release for that game, because it would have been a long, dreary summer without being able to just kind of focus on that. And it brought all the things that I liked about Castlevania Symphony of the Night, but into kind of a smaller, more compact form and with better depth. And, in some ways, it was just a better game. And so that kept me, I guess, from being too scarred. Oh, wait, no, it's across the road, not down the highway.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah. Hey, guys, my name's Steve. I'm from Seattle, and I actually have a scarring memory. So this is probably around the summer of 2000, and me and my friend Mike were going to go to our friend Ian's apartment and pick him up and, go out to dinner or whatever. And, he was like, yeah, come over, we'll do whatever. And he had, by the time we got there, he had acquired a copy of Ogre Battle 64 and had just started he'd been playing it for a while, I guess, but he was in mid-battle. And you guys got to correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know, but he claimed he couldn't save those battles midway, so we couldn't stop. He had to finish this thing. And we sat in that hot-ass 90-degree apartment for what, I may be exaggerating, but it felt like 3 hours waiting for him to finish this thing. And I can not even look at Ogre Battle 64 without seething rage. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Thanks.
Could you save in mid-battle? I never played that one.
I don't remember. Oh.
Hey, Eric here from Seattle, and summer memory. I was thinking about I had a Uncle Barry when I was a kid. Uncle Barry had a pool, and Uncle Barry had a NES with a really big library of games. And every summer we go out there and use the pool, but I would end up just in the basement playing his NES, and they would try to get me outside. And I was like, he just got Super Mario 3, so I don't think I ever got in that pool. All the summers.
That's so right. NES is why you don't know how to swim.
What was that?
NES is why you don't know how to swim.
I mean, it's not.
No, it's just be honest. It's why.
All right.
I had a similar experience also like that, but it was with Earthbound. I'm not sure if I told this. I remember the day I got it. It was a great summer day. My family was in the pool. They're like, come on out. I was like, no. And I closed the curtains and turned up the air conditioning. I'm a hermit now. So,
hey, hope I'm close enough to this mic. I'm Chris. I'm originally from the Bay Area and currently living here in Seattle. And one of my earliest summer memories is the summer of 1992 when I got myself a Super Nintendo. And I was doing a lot of chores to be actually be able to get that, but it was worth the while to have that bundled in with Super Mario World, I think it was. It was such a fun game to play back then.
Yeah, that was that's something that kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of gaming in the summer for me is, you know, you want all these games, but you only have this much money. So doing chores and mowing lawns for people is a big part of the gaming. And I think that helps kind of cement the fond memories for those because you worked really hard for them.
Oh, yeah. And also, I bought it from Walmart, so I paid a little less. But unfortunately, the color went out on me 5 years later in the summer of 97, so I'd power swap it while playing Soul Blazer.
Ah, fun.
At least it died happy.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yep. Hey, guys. I'm Garrett, and I'm from around here. But I grew up in this, like, tiny town in the middle of Washington State, and there's nowhere to buy video games, so I just have to get my parents to drive into neighboring cities and get stuff and then come back and just kind of blast through those for a while. But in the summer of 98, like, I had an N64, and there's just a paucity of games to play, basically, until Zelda 64 came out. So I started renting Super Nintendo games again, just from, like, this mom-and-pop rental store, and I discovered Final Fantasy III, like, really late, but I just thought, man, I have to buy this, and I didn't know how to buy things on the internet or anything back then, and I knew I wouldn't be able to, like, find it at, like, Target or anything, because it was 4 years old. But I was about to, like, place a mail order with this rental store, but then I looked behind the person at the desk, and they actually had it new, sealed, just for $30.
Oh, my God.
I was like, oh, never mind. I just want to buy that. And, like, even at the time, I knew that was a super good deal. So
right.
I just bought it and spent the rest of the summer playing that. So that was super exciting. And
Yeah. You won't get that deal again.
Nope, sure won't.
So
and now everything's damaged, so it's not worth anything anymore. So. But yeah, thanks.
I've got two things to say again. First of all, I actually rented the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game for NES, and I didn't get very far in it.
That's the story of everyone's life.
Yeah.
I didn't even get to the Nintendo hard parts, like the dam.
To me, that game really just has one level. And when I get to that, it's okay. That's enough Ninja Turtles.
I guess I could have mentioned that as a scarring memory.
And one more thing. I actually found GoldenEye 64 for half price at a pawn shop shortly after it was released.
I know that was hard to find at the time because no one expected it to be good, and then everyone bought it. So,
yeah. Man, pawn shops were such a great place to find great game deals before the rise of eBay. Now pawn shop guys are really savvy and are like, oh, yeah, this game is really expensive. Thanks. I miss those days.
Thanks.
And those darn reality shows.
And Retro Game Roadshow.
Hi. Okay, yeah, I'm Peter. I'm from Seattle. I'm thinking I'm older than many of you because for me it was the Atari that was the formative one. And
got some applause. That's officially a smattering.
Hmm?
That's officially a smattering of applause. So
yeah, right. Of course, the combat cartridge, that was the pack-in, and you know, by modern standards, all those games are completely laughable, but they were fun to play with other people, and I kind of like the, I still like Tank Pong if I'm going to play anything on the Atari cartridge, on the Atari. And now my friend Chris, he had two cartridges, which I thought were great. Of course, because he had them, I never got them. It just didn't make sense. Adventure, which is the one which, you know, you're basically a square which moves around, and then Superman, which, and many of these games they had little, some of them just had quirks which were just like bad programming. Of course, like Superman, you could he would fly by Lois Lane and there'd be this kind of ding sound when he would kiss her, so you could kiss Lois Lane and. And Chris showed me how he could pick up Lois Lane, and it would go like ding, 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 and then you could go into the phone booth and close the door, ding, ding, ding.
So was that was the first dating sim, I guess?
Maybe.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that.
No rating on that or anything.
Yeah.
Also, he had the Maze Craze cartridge, which I think is pretty good. One of the things which he used to do was flip the power switch really fast in order to create what he called a weirdy maze, which didn't really make any sense. Most of the time you could play it. Of course, he learned not to do that anymore, but just the fact that we did that kind of shows you a lot that, maybe we were kind of bored with the Atari. Maybe there's only so much like the Atari Pac-Man. I got it for my birthday, and I think my father got it. I don't know. There's some story behind it. Hmm. They got it from the back room. You can only play that thing for so long, basically, before you...
infamous Atari Pac-Man.
Yeah, after a while, you start to hate Pac-Man.
Yeah, well, I do want to mention... in the 90s, I used to drive around to different, I had a car and money, and I would hit a bunch of different thrift stores and just find stuff like Atari 5200s and ColecoVision controllers that were just spilling out of them in those days. And that's that doesn't really happen anymore, but you can still find stuff like that. So, and I know, some people hit thrift shops daily just to get the good stuff. So, if you're into hunting, then you should probably... Most of the stuff I've seen, N64 controllers, I think, and stuff like that. But, seriously, anything could show up. So I think it's a good hint to keep in mind. But thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, the king of game thrifting has a panel up next, actually. So stick around if you're interested in hearing war stories.
Hey, guys, I'm Jesse. Seattle native. I just want to tell you a quick story about the summer of 97.
Could you get a little closer to the mic?
Excuse me, Jesse, Seattle, Washington. Summer 97, there was a little bit of hype going on in some of the game magazines about Final Fantasy VII coming, previews of the game, the Japanese version, and me and my friends would talk about oh, that's great, it's coming soon, it's going to be nice in September, and I had never played a Final Fantasy game, ever. I had a Genesis growing up, all my friends had Super Nintendos, I was a fool, doubled down on the Sega CD instead of getting the Super Nintendo, so I missed out. Lunar's cool, but I missed out.
Nice.
Anyway, so my friends were kind of making fun of me. I went home one evening in June after we had been talking about it, and it was raining, and there was a black garbage bag on the doorstep of my house, just misshapen. I was like, what the heck is this? And my mom was driving me home, and she's like, what the heck is this? Jesse, this is probably one of your friends. And I rip it open, and my friend had spray-painted his old Super Nintendo black and metallic gold, and it was a copy of Final Fantasy III and the Super Nintendo, and there was no note. And it was just, you can go ahead. Now you can experience Final Fantasy III. You can play this before Final Fantasy VII comes out. So I took it inside, hooked it up to an old 13-inch TV, and spent pretty much the whole summer playing my first Final Fantasy game, Final in 1997.
Did you send him a really nice Christmas card that year? Because you have good friends.
Yeah. I think I repaid him.
I never find good things in anonymous trash bags.
Maybe. I felt a little shady opening. I was like, and it was left out in the rain on my doorstep. Pretty weird. Anyway, thanks a bunch, guys.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm James from Seattle. I've got two summer memories, one from 1990 and one from 96. Back in 90, I was living up in Anchorage, Alaska, and it was summer vacation. I'd perused the classifieds, because this is before Craigslist and eBay and whatnot. And some guy had listed a copy of Phantasy Star 2, because I had a Genesis back then. So I got my brother to drive me over to this guy's place, picked up the game, and I spent all summer playing that. But the amazing thing in retrospect was that it was complete. It had not only the manual and the case, but also the strategy guide, which it was sold with at the time. And that was my introduction to JRPGs, and I don't think I would have finished it without that mini strategy guide book. But in 96, I'm glad you mentioned this, Ray, about the toy test at the Science Center. Because that year, I don't know how we found out about it. It must have been promoted in the paper or something. But a friend and I went that year, and I remember we were playing Tekken 2, and I was using Law, and my friend was amazed at how well I was doing, but I was just mashing the kick button, because you could do that with him. He'd whip out these massive combos. But that was our fighting game summer, because at the time I had a 27-inch or 32-inch CRT TV with picture-in-picture. And I had a PlayStation and a Saturn. So on the main screen, we were playing Battle Arena Toshinden 2, And then on the small screen, we were playing Virtua Fighter 2. So we stayed up like all night, like four of us, just alternating between the windows.
Wow. Yeah.
That is a great abuse of technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Frank. Seattle. First memory probably as a kid was Pong, believe it or not, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, you go to a pizza parlor, right? And on your video arcade machine, you had Pong, so you played it in a pizza place. And then you could bring that home. That was pretty cool.
Oh, right,
my
yeah.
best memory was somebody gave me a projection TV mm-hmm. with a big screen. I don't know if you guys remember those things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And me and my buddy get an idea to play Zelda on it because it's going to be on a big screen like that. So we play it for like 8 hours.
Yeah.
Then my wife gets home, he goes home and stuff. We start watching TV on it, and it's burned in a screen.
Yep. I was going to ask you that.
With the hearts and all that kind of stuff, and it's like, well, what do we do with this now? Well,
yeah.
I think that made every parent fear video games would ruin their TVs for at least 20 years, like regardless of what kind of TV it was.
Thank
you. Yeah, thanks.
Hey, guys, I'm from Ohio again. Two stories of gullibility. One, I was about 6 or 7 years old, and we were playing Mega Man 2 on the NES. And I didn't know much about playing the game. I was terrible at it. My older brother would come up to me and goes, "If you fall in the spikes right there, you'll fall into a secret warp and go to a secret level." So for the next hour, I'm jumping over and over again.
If you jump to the spikes, Mega Man will evolve into pure energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was... Thankfully, years later, the internet kind of backed me up. We were playing Dragon Ball GT Final Bout on the PlayStation.
Sure.
Oh, boy.
And this being the early days of the internet, we'd seen this cheat online. It's like, if you beat the game with a certain character 150 times in a row, you unlock a secret character.
Yeah.
So we spent the entire weekend alternating between us with the game continually running, beating the game over and over and over again. And we're eventually disappointed.
Great summer.
Yeah, that Mega Man spike thing is something I've actually been a culprit of. There was I took my copy of Mega Man over to a friend's house and we were playing, and their neighbor's kid came over. He was half our age, and so my friend's mom was like, "You need to let him play," and so my friend was really irritated. And so as he was playing, he had no idea what he was doing, and he shot something, and a power up fell into the spikes, and my friend and I were like, "Oh yeah, you need to go jump and get that item." And we kept doing things like that to him to troll him and make him die a lot. Because we were dicks, basically.
Team building.
kids.
Hi again. Another one of my memories I had was back in 1990 when the first Ninja Turtles arcade game was out. And, I kind of played it in the spring. It was pretty popular, but it gained popularity. I didn't need to play it much then. But I think after the summer of 1990, when it was going to the fall, I saw this one video arcade that had a second screen on top of the coin op. Because a lot of people would gather around, and everybody couldn't see it at once. So they had the screen up on the top, and so everyone else in the arcade could see it as well.
Was that a special setup?
Yeah.
Okay.
Must have been, yeah.
Yeah, it was in a video arcade, Regency Sun Valley Mall, I believe.
Hmm. I've never seen one of those, but that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think it's kind of got how the idea came about also with the Sky Church DMP a couple months ago with the... The game night 2, and they had all the games being played. I kind of put the both screens on at the same time.
Right. Weird. Yeah. I never seen that before.
Yeah, it's fun to see. Here we go too.
Okay, everyone. I guess that's.
No, wait. I have one last memory, and it's actually about a retro game con. Because I went to the first Classic Gaming Expo in 99.
Oh wow!
Once again, made my mom drive us. That was a very interesting experience because also my first time in Vegas. It was in Vegas, and so I don't want to go back, but it was fun being at CGE, and I think that's where I got my Lynx for like $30 and like all of the decent games for it. Slime World, Kung Fu, Ninja Gaiden. Yeah, here we go. Blue Thunder, sorry. Yeah. But yeah, that was a good experience, and here I am again, sort of, in the same sort of thing, except now I'm doing a panel.
So, all right, well, thanks everyone for coming out to see us, and thanks again for supporting Retronauts on Kickstarter, and by downloading our podcasts and so forth. Bob, do you want to do the closing spiel? since you're so good at it.
I don't know if we need to do it here.
Sure, why not?
Please visit us at Retronauts.com. We're Retronauts on everything. So if you go to any social media website, look for Retronauts, it's probably us. If not, let us know. We'll hunt them down.
Did we get our Pinterest page yet? I can't remember.
Pinterest page?
Yeah, retro flowers and retro dresses and things like that.
But maybe one of you guys can do that. Yeah, and also I think our podcast will be on iTunes soon. We submitted it, and once that goes into iTunes, it'll be searchable, findable. And if you guys could rate us and review us, that'd be great, because it actually makes our podcast more visible to other people, and we want other people to listen to us too. You guys are still important, though. Don't worry. What about the pizza party?
Oh, right. Yes. And, well, maybe that's a... is it actually a party in the sense that we're providing pizza, or are we
the restaurant
providing
doesn't
a place
know
for
we're
people
coming.
To go and eat their own pizza?
Well, it's come and eat pizza, but we'll be there too.
So you can join us to eat pizza at Pagliacci's Pizza on Queen Anne. It's really close. It's like 3 blocks away. We're going to head over there like, what, 5:30 or so?
After Chris Kohler's panel, because I want to go check out Chris's panel, and I don't want to steal you guys from that. So
yeah.
Well, whenever that ends, we'll be heading over to the pizza place. So I'm not sure if it has gelato, but that would be delicious.
A gelato pizza, perhaps?
That's taking fusion a little too far.
Yeah, so anyway, thanks for coming to our first panel for Retronauts, and we'll be at 2 other events in the coming year. We don't know which ones. Maybe the Portland Retro Game Show.
Sure.
We won't be at PAX. Maybe PAX East. We don't know. It's a mystery. but stay tuned to our podcast and to our website, and you'll find out all these things, and perhaps we'll see you again there. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.